Well, happy 4th of July. It's what a great day to be together and to celebrate part of the story of our nation. It's also another anniversary that we can recognize, and this is the 49th wedding anniversary of Dan and Clarice, so congratulations. As we as a nation and a community can celebrate our independence, you can celebrate your submitting to one another. Wonderful example. Well, Deanna's back from vacation, and the Boers are back from vacation, and Deanna has been leading singing, but I'm delivering the message. And the Boers are hosting Red, White, and Boom this afternoon. So things are returning more towards their normal routine. Last week, we heard a great message from Kent, and today I'll be speaking. Next week, Dion will be sharing God's message with us again. The message today has two parts, a very short, practical part, and then a second part that talks about all the reasons why the first part is important. And if you prefer straightforward directions and very practical instructions on the one hand, and really don't like explanations that can sometimes be a little abstract, you really might want to pay extra attention to the first part. Just checking on where Travis is sitting. Okay, yeah. No commentary. Yeah, the message today has two parts. And when raising our children, I often repeated the three pillars of wisdom. Do what is right, do your job, do what you love. I taught our kids that if they followed these three instructions, that would answer almost all of the questions they would face in life. And I used it a lot. But what if you don't follow these instructions? What do you do if you skip one or forget another? And then what do? Should you try to go back and do it over? Well, no. Whether you're working through the three pillars of wisdom or simply working your way through life, when you make a mistake or get off track, the best advice I've ever heard comes from Melissa Berry by way of Kent. Wherever you find yourself, it is always the right time to do the next right thing. Don't stress over what you missed or what you got wrong. You can always begin again and do the next right thing. And so here's the first part of the message this morning. What is the next right thing for this body to do? We can all support our Wednesday night cookouts starting this week. And they go throughout every Wednesday in July. That's it. That is the first part of the message, the practical part. And if you give financially to this church family, you've already provided support, important support, for our Wednesday night cookouts. And if you are able, I encourage you to join us for the next few Wednesday evenings starting at 6:30 p.m. If you notice the sign across the street, the Methodist Church is also gathering for meals. Now, they're from 4:30 to 6:30, so it doesn't overlap, but it's a let's just call it a nice setup for our cookout. If that part of the message has registered with you this morning, then you already know what to do. And if you don't need to hear the reasons why we have Wednesday night cookouts or why they are important, well, then you have all you need to participate. Well, why do we have Wednesday night cookouts? The answer is simple. We have Wednesday night cookouts to get to know people in this community who aren't members of this church family. And why is that important? Why do we make an effort to connect with people who aren't in this church family? Well, because we're followers of Jesus. We are his disciples. We make an effort to connect with others because that's what we see Jesus doing in the Gospels. Jesus interacted with sinners a lot during his ministry on earth. And in my notes, I've got quotes around the word sinners because the Bible says we're all sinners. And when I talk about sinners today, I'm talking about the people that Jesus was trying to reach and the people that we are trying to reach. Most aren't any worse sinners than you or me. Although some of those who were close to Jesus did have a reputation for serious sin. But I'm using the term sinners today mainly to refer to those who aren't part of God's family. Jesus made a point of being around sinners a lot during his earthly ministry. And that was something that bothered the religious leaders of the Jews. They viewed the law of Moses as forbidding close interaction with those who aren't following the law. They remembered Israel's history and recalled God's punishment when their ancestors ignored the law of Moses. They felt that if Jesus were a true prophet, he should be able to tell who were righteous and who were sinners. They thought that a true prophet of God would avoid interaction or connecting with sinners. And because Jesus did not avoid or withdraw from sinners, many religious leaders concluded that Jesus was a false prophet. Now, sometimes sinners came to Jesus. And I'm reading here from Luke chapter 15. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering, and this is all from the NIV. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." And this is just one example from the Gospels that states that people who were not following God were drawn to Jesus. The text doesn't say why they were drawn to Jesus. The text just prior to this, Jesus is talking about the costs of being his disciples. And he speaks in extremes. And it seems odd that the next sentence would be that the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear. And there are other examples of sinners seeking Jesus. This from the 7th chapter of Luke. When one of the Pharisees invited Jesus to have dinner with him, he went to the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. A woman in that town who lived a sinful life learned that Jesus was eating at the Pharisee's house. So she came there with an alabaster jar of perfume. As she stood behind him at his feet weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears. Then she wiped them with her hair, kissed them, and poured perfume on them. When the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, "If this man were a prophet, he would know who was touching him and what kind of woman she is, that she is a sinner." This woman may have been drawn to Jesus seeking forgiveness, a desire to start over. We don't know. The text says she caused an incident at the dinner and that Jesus forgives her sins, saying her faith has saved her. Sometimes Jesus seeks the sinner and maybe even shows them a little extra attention. This from the 19th chapter of Luke. Jesus entered Jericho when was passing through. A man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was wealthy. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but because he was short, he could not see over the crowd. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore fig tree to see him, since Jesus was coming that way. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today." So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. All the people who saw this and began to mutter, "He is gone to be the guest of a sinner." So we've got examples of sinners seeking Jesus. We've got an example of Jesus seeking a sinner. This is a good example of someone wanting to see Jesus and of Jesus making a special point of connecting with that person. "Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today." We don't know why Jesus wanted to honor Zacchaeus, but the text leaves little doubt that honoring Zacchaeus was his goal. And it certainly caused a wide negative reaction. Sometimes sinners are seeking Jesus. Sometimes Jesus is seeking sinners. Sometimes Jesus encounters sinners seemingly by accident. Neither is really seeking the other. This from the 4th chapter of John. Now he had gone through Samaria, and he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about noon. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" His disciples had gone into the town to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "You are a Jew, and I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews do not associate with Samaritans." Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." Now, this seems to be a chance encounter. We know that later in this conversation, Jesus brings up the failed marriages of this woman. And Bible scholars also tell us that it is very unusual to be drawing water from a well at noon, meaning that the woman was likely wanting to avoid contact with other people. I don't want to read too much into the text, but Jesus treats her as he would any other person, any other Samaritan, any other Jewish, any other male Jew, and starts a conversation with a common request. Her response, it's a little bit loaded. And Jesus not only accepts the response, but seems to raise the stakes with an even more spiritually significant, challenging response. And we know what happens in this conversation. Jesus wants to get to the heart of the matter, but waits until her statements invite him. When the subject gets really serious and really personal, this brave woman doesn't back away and is rewarded by learning who Jesus is. So there are plenty of examples of Jesus interacting or being around or drawing sinners to him. Now, does this mean Jesus didn't think sin was serious or not important? Does this mean that Jesus thought sin was okay? I don't think so. Jesus wasn't soft or lenient on sin. And he does address sin in his public preaching. I would say not nearly as often as he spoke about the kingdom of heaven, but he does address sin. For example, from the Sermon on the Mount, we're all very familiar with, and this from the fifth chapter of Matthew. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I tell you, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen, will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished. Therefore, anyone who sets aside one of the least of these commands and teaches others accordingly will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever practices and teaches these commands will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, these don't sound like words of someone who is lenient on sin. This theme is reinforced later in this same sermon, again from the fifth chapter of Matthew. If your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off, throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. Jesus takes sin and its consequences very seriously. He states that you have been taught that the law requires this, but I say that this is what is really required. And when it came to sin, Jesus' standards were much higher, even higher than that of the Pharisees. So no, I don't think it is accurate to say that Jesus didn't care about sin or was soft on sin. I do think it is accurate to say that confronting sinners with their sin was rarely the theme of his public teaching. Now, he is certainly willing to confront the crowds that follow him. At one point, he refers to everyone who's listening to him as offspring of Satan. But other than pointing out their unwillingness to believe in him, he rarely confronts his public audiences with their sin. There is an important exception to this. On several occasions, Jesus confronts the hypocrisy of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. And he publicly criticizes this group for condemning those who violate the law of Moses without offering any help to the lawbreakers. But the main focus of his teaching really isn't confronting sin, at least not directly. As it is written, for God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world through him. John 3:17. Okay, so Jesus interacts with and focuses on sinners. Jesus isn't soft on sin, and Jesus' primary mission isn't to condemn sinners. All right. What is his primary mission? The gospel gives us some wonderful answers to that question. From Luke 19, verse 10, for the Son of Man came to seek and save the lost. From the first part of the of Matthew 20, the first part of 28. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. And the last part of that verse, and to give his life as a ransom for many. John 10, verse 10. I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. All of these are the primary mission of Jesus. And there are other great verses that speak very directly to his mission. And really, his mission is not his own or of his own choosing. His mission is to do whatever God the Father has commanded. From the 12th chapter of John, for I did not speak on my own, but the Father who sent me commanded me to say all that I have spoken. I know that his command leads to eternal life. So whatever I say is just what the Father has told me to say. He goes further later in John, the 5th chapter of John. His mission is to do whatever he sees the Father doing. Jesus gave them this answer. Very truly, I tell you, the Son can do nothing by himself. He can do only what he sees his Father doing, because whatever the Father does, the Son also does. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all he does. So why does Jesus focus on sinners? Because he sees his Father doing that. And the mission of Jesus is to seek and save the lost. Why do we as a church focus on sinners? No. Why do we as a church focus on Wednesday night cookouts and community of care? Because we do what we see Jesus doing. And our mission is to make disciples. Jesus focuses on sinners. We focus on sinners. And who are sinners? All have sinned. Those of us who are disciples have merely been forgiven. We are all sinners. And how do we connect with sinners? Well, we're disciples of Jesus. We connect with sinners the way Jesus connected with sinners. And how did Jesus connect with sinners? With love. In fact, Jesus said that all the law and prophets, in other words, the entire Old Testament, all the law and the prophets hung on two commands. Neither which of these commands actually appear in the Ten Commandments, but they hang on two commands. And both of these commands include the command to love. Love God with everything that you are, and love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus said not only did he come to fulfill the law and the prophets, but that all the law and the prophets hung on those two commands. And to these, he added a third command, which also included a command to love. At the last meal he shared with his disciples before he was arrested, and this from the 13th chapter of John, a new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. Well, how did Jesus love? And what does loving like Jesus look like? Well, it depends on the relationship, and it depends on the situation in question. Sometimes it looks like forgiving someone caught in the act of adultery. Sometimes it looks like telling a close follower to get behind me, Satan. Sometimes it looks like asking a hated tax collector if you could stay with him. The call to love as Jesus loves is a call to relationship, to connect with people and to show kindness to others. And that is really what our Wednesday evening cookouts are all about, a chance to be family together and to share that love with members of this community. And just to be sure, what does the love that we are called to share look like? How is it described? Well, I'm going to jump out of the Gospels into one of the letters, 1 Corinthians 13. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. So Wednesday evening at the cookout, if you're at the cookout and you're wondering how to interact with others, remember that passage from 1 Corinthians. We want to connect in love. I'm glad my family is family with you in this church family. We can help each other as we all seek to follow Jesus. We are his disciples. We submit together to his leading, including in reaching out to others during our Wednesday night cookouts and at Community of Care. Now, before we close, and praise team, you can probably begin to get ready. Before we close, I want to say something about the 4th of July. Our nation's story is an Exodus narrative and a promised land, an arrival on a promised land. Most of our ancestors left the tyranny of serfdom in Europe or regulation of faith and other conditions of frightening inequality in search of the promised land. Well, or at least the chance to own the land that they worked and to worship God as their conscience directed. And we are the beneficiaries of those decisions, and we enjoy the freedoms they valued. But every Exodus story and arrival into a promised land for one people is another people's loss of homeland and ability to live as they had lived before, and sometimes the enslavement of others. This land of the free has struggled to restore equality in its past, and it struggles in the present and will continue to struggle to restore equality in our future. As long as there are people whose hearts are twisted by the fall of man, there will be unfairness. There will be inequality, even in the abundance of freedom. Now, Jesus lived in extremely unequal times. The Roman Empire was brutal. It was ruled by a dictator. About 90% of its inhabitants were slaves. Now, not all those slaves lived in the same conditions of slaves on plantations in the South before the Civil War, but about 90% of its inhabitants were slaves. Most social relationships involved an authority and a subject. In Judea, where Jesus lived, minority suppression, including women and ethnic exclusion, would be shocking by 21st century standards. And what we call patriarchy was about as natural as gravity. Jesus' ministry doesn't focus on addressing really any of these wrongs. He famously refuses to get drawn into debates about any of this, including Roman occupation. In the face of savage inequalities, Jesus seeks to address very few of these injustices, at least directly in his public preaching. Instead, Jesus focuses on the source, redeeming that fallen, twisted human heart. And his remedy to fix the heart was to encourage us to give up our freedom and submit to him, just as he submits to God the Father. From Luke, the 9th chapter, verse 23. Then he said to them all, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross daily and follow me." And also, from the 11th chapter of Matthew, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Both of these statements, as different as they are from each other, are an invitation from Jesus to follow him. Jesus asks us to surrender, to start over, to be born again, and to submit to him completely. On this day, when we as a nation celebrate our independence and our freedom, let those of us in God's family remember that we are ultimately created to use that freedom from God, to submit to God, to deny ourselves, and to seek what God desires. And when we embrace God's design for us, yes, our burdens fall away. God gives us real rest. Everyone, consciously or not, uses their freedom to submit to something. That's how we're created. Jesus offers the chance to submit to God. Let's use our freedom to become better followers of Jesus. Thank you.